Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Which would you rather have happen? Sit idly by while the government slaps tough new rules on your multi-billion dollar company? Or wangle yourself a seat at the table so you can help write those rules? The people running the oil giant ConocoPhillips are pretty savvy, so they took option number two today and so became the first big oil company to favor mandatory limits on greenhouse gases. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's April 11th. ConocoPhillips is this country's second largest oil refiner. It's part of an industry that's been remarkably cohesive when it comes to public policy. But Conoco has stepped out alone. While other big oil companies have supported voluntary steps to control global warming, Pat Loeb reports ConocoPhillips announced today it's serious.
Conoco's climate change policy includes improving energy efficiency at its facilities, investing in alternative fuels, and anticipating paying for carbon emissions in the future. Most significantly, today it announced it's joining the Climate Action Partnership. That's a group of major businesses lobbying for mandatory caps on emissions. London-based BP Oil is already a member, but Conoco spokesman Bill Tanner says Conoco is the first U.S. oil company to join.
We want to be involved in a public policy discussion on what is the best and most efficient path forward from here.
Conoco's announcement was roundly applauded by environmental groups. Trillium, a firm that specializes in socially responsible investment, had been critical of Conoco for failing to invest in zero carbon fuels. But Trillium's Shelley Alpern says today's announcement is a positive turnaround.
What's changed in recent months is that the old strategy was for big oil just to fight climate change bill tooth and nail. But now everybody wants to weigh in on how it's going to be written.
But, Alpern says, having big oil at the table to work on emission caps could be a double-edged sword.
We're not going to see any legislation until industry gets involved in writing it, but we can't let industry dominate the content of any climate change bill that comes out.
Many energy analysts and environmentalists predict that other U.S. oil companies will follow Conoco's lead, if only because they don't want to be left out as new regulations are debated. I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
It might be time to pull out the calculator and rework the budget for that summer vacation you're planning. The government reported a sharp drop in the nation's gasoline inventories today, down 5.5 million barrels from a week earlier. Gas futures jumped 3 cents a gallon on the news, hit the highest price since last August at one point. And here it is, only the second week of April, miles from the summer driving season. Still, though, our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale did find some good news in those falling inventories.
Gasoline stockpiles have been dropping for more than 2 months, caused by strong demand and weak supply. There have been some unexpected refinery outages, including one caused by a possum and another by a raccoon. Plus, the chief economist at the American Petroleum Institute, John Felmy, says it's been cold.
We have seen a little bit of a delay in switching from winter fuels to summer because of the lengthened cold conditions, but it appears as though they're starting to make the transition because the refiners have to have summer fuel at terminals by May 1st for most of the country.
We're paying about 11 cents more per gallon than last April for gasoline. That's due in part to the jump in crude oil prices after Iran took those British sailors prisoner. The peaceful resolution of that crisis, combined with an increase in oil inventories, means there should be some price relief in the next few weeks. Tom Wallen at Energy Intelligence says the gasoline bill might not be so bad this summer, thanks in part to fewer regulatory requirements.
we don't have so many major changes in specifications that are coming through the system that require refiners to modify what they're doing. We also have a big increase in ethanol production, and that's going to add to the gasoline supply pool.
Due to the current healthy supply of crude, the government's Energy Information Agency is forecasting only a modest increase in gas prices for the summer, less than $3 a gallon on average, and a few cents a gallon cheaper than last summer. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The official position of the Bush administration is that the American military is not stretched thin by Iraq and Afghanistan. Defense Secretary Robert Gates extended troop deployments to those places today, and that put a slightly different spin on things.
Effective immediately, active Army units now in the Central Command area of responsibility, and those headed there will deploy for not more than 15 months and will return home to home station for not less than 12 months.
We reached Gordon Adams at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington to talk about that announcement. Gordon, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Guy.
One of the many things that comes to mind is how we're going to pay for this. You know, Congress is still trying to figure out a $103 billion request. What do you think the White House is thinking?
Well, I think the Congress is going to put forward some money. The White House will probably veto what the Congress has put forward. They'll go back and argue about it a bit, and Congress will come up with additional supplementary funds, and there'll be some kind of a compromise on language about where we go from here with presidential waivers and the like. Congress is going to be prepared to fund it, and frankly, the announcement they made today is not going to cost a whole heck of a lot more money.
The expense would come, I would guess, in troop morale and the prospect of spending now an extra 3 months, an extra 25% of their time in country.
The critical issue here, and what the secretary said, was he wants to send a clear signal to the troops that are there, active duty, and the troops that are going to be sent there in the near future, that they can expect to leave, to be there for 15 months, and then to come home after 15 months. This seems to be an answer to two questions. One is, how do you let families know that these numbers aren't going to keep shifting around how long you're here, how long you're there, when do you go, when do you come back? And the other is to leave open to the president an option that, frankly, has always been on the table, and that is to extend the surge past the end of this summer.
Is it credible still for the White House to say that the Pentagon's not stretched thin?
No, I think the Department of Defense is stretched thin. I think the White House acknowledges that they are stretched thin, and they have been juggling. They are, frankly, juggling all the way along. That's not the same thing as saying that the force is broken. You can stretch this military pretty far. It's a volunteer force. What I think they're really talking about here is how do we set up the option to ensure that we can continue at a larger force level in Iraq through next March.
How do you feed it on the back end, though? The military is already reducing enlistment standards at the same time that Secretary Gates has called for a larger standing army and a larger standing Marine Corps.
They're going to have a very hard time getting the forces to come forward to volunteer for that larger standing army, and it's going to take them a lot of years. In effect, increasing the overall size of the army is not going to solve the problem that we're talking about in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those forces aren't going to be available for you for 3 to 5 years from now before they're going to really enter the force and be usable, and we're in some future situation by then.
Gordon Adams at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Gordon, good to speak with you as always.
Thanks, Guy.
Changing gears completely now, you have to be pretty fond of your alma mater, not to mention pretty well off, to make them a gift of $400 million. Lucky for Columbia University, then, that they've got a graduate who meets that description. 92-year-old John Kluge made his billions in the broadcast industry. Columbia announced this morning he's made the largest gift ever in higher education devoted just to financial aid. We asked Ashley Milne-Tite to figure out what kind of student aid you can get for $400 million.
The university says $200 million will go to supporting and expanding existing financial aid programs for undergrads. Jeff Salingo of the Chronicle of Higher Education says Columbia is already trying to provide for students whose family income is less than $50,000. He says the university tells the prospective student that if they get in,
we'll make sure that there's enough financial aid between federal grants and institution grants that you will not have to take out any loans. And these programs are incredibly expensive.
So the massive bequest will play a big part in fleshing out Columbia's program. As for the other $200 million, that's slated for scholarships and fellowships at the graduate level. Economist David Brenneman says the gift will give the school a certain edge.
This would give them a lot of market power in attracting students, frankly, away from some of their competitors.
Columbia is receiving its huge gift for financial aid at the same time that its top financial aid official is caught up in the ongoing student loan scandal.
The irony, I suppose, is this should reduce the reliance of Columbia students on loans.
Brenneman says the money could insulate the university from future scandal, because with this windfall, Columbia won't need to rely so much on outside lenders. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Wall Street's winning streak is over at 8. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Citigroup confirmed today it's getting rid of 17,000 jobs. That's about 5% of the workforce at the world's biggest financial services company. Another 9,500 jobs are moving to, quote, lower-cost locations worldwide. Word on the street is a good number of them will land in India, which puts today's news smack in the middle of two major trends that are forcing economists to rethink some of their assumptions about free trade.
Electronics and India.
That's Alan Blinder. He's an economist at Princeton University. For years, he was an avid free trader. Still is, actually. But he says announcements like Citigroup's highlight the costs that come with the benefits of globalization.
Electronic communications means that a whole range of services that we used to think of as not tradable between countries now is becoming tradable. And India is it's not the only one, but it's a major source now of skilled English-speaking labor.
And are we losing more of those jobs than you ever thought?
So far, this is still a relatively small phenomenon, although for the people that are already impacted by it, it doesn't seem very small at all. But I believe that as the electronic communications continue to improve, as they've been, and as countries like India, China, the Philippines, and many others educate more and more people and get more and more businesses involved in this offshoring process, it's going to be a very big deal indeed.
You know, if you go to an economist's convention and you survey a room full of them, they're probably going to say, most of them anyway, that free trade is a good thing and that it generally advances the economic well-being of most of the people in the world. Are they all wrong?
No, they're all right. And I'll be in that convention voting the same side. Absolutely. Let me give you a large-scale analogy. Suppose you were privileged in the year 1802 to walk into President Jefferson's office and say, you know what, President Jefferson? Right now, 83% of Americans earn their living on farms. In 150 years, that'll be about 3%. You know, Jefferson might have asked you, well, what will the other 80% do? And, of course, you wouldn't have known, and nobody would have known, but they found better things to do than working on farms. And so in the end, I think we're going to have huge gains from this process. What I'm worried about is getting from here to there.
Define that. What's the progression?
Well, what has to happen is a whole lot of people, many millions of people, are going to lose jobs to foreign competition. And a whole lot of other people, overlapping but not exactly the same people, are going to gain jobs. And we in America don't do a very good job of taking care of our job losers, the displaced workers, whether they lose it for trade or any other reason. It's particularly hard for older people who can't very well retrain for the new sorts of jobs. It has been historically particularly hard for uneducated people, but I think it's now going to start hitting educated people.
How long is this transition going to last?
Long time. I think we're talking about a generation, probably.
Tricky then, because the people who are going to benefit or be most harmed by it are, you know, 2 years old now.
That's correct. Some of them are 2 years old, some of them are 20 years old, some of them are 40 years old. And, you know, if you go to a real person as opposed to a theoretical person and say, you know, it may be a rough 20 years, but then things will be fine. That's not much solace.
Well, then, what do we do to carry this forward? Is there a secret or a trick or a mindset to have as the U.S. and the government tries to keep prospering in an era of free trade?
Well, I don't think there's any one silver bullet. There are a few things. First, I would say, don't succumb to the allure of protectionism. It doesn't work, and it certainly won't work for electronic trade. I mean, how can we stop electrons? Secondly, as I was saying before, we just have to do a better job with the social safety net so that job displacement doesn't hold the ravages that it now holds to the typical American. Thirdly, I think we have to think in terms of those kids you were talking about what we need to do with our educational system so that we're training kids for the jobs that will actually be available in the United States when they leave the school system, not the jobs that will have migrated overseas. And then finally, I think we have to get used to the idea that if we want to stay the richest country in the world, which I presume we do, we can't try to hang on to sunset industries. We have to specialize in sunrise industries. That's, again, not a news story. It's been the story of the United States for decades now, and we're pretty good at it, frankly.
Alan Blinder, an economist at Princeton University. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, one source of China's water crisis.
Basically, they turn all these rivers and lakes as their natural sewers.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street got spooked today by a peek behind the door at the Federal Reserve. The minutes from the central bank's most recent meeting showed much of the discussion was focused on whether interest rates might need to go higher to control inflation. With hopes for a rate cut apparently dashed on the rocks, investors sent the Dow tumbling 89 points. That's almost 0.75% to close at 12,484. The Nasdaq dropped 18 points, 0.75%, ending at 2459. The S&P 500 lost 9 points, 0.2%, wrapping up trading at 1438. Even before the Fed's revelations, though, the market was already reeling from a forecast of falling home prices. The National Association of Realtors is now projecting the first annual drop in prices for existing homes since it began keeping records back in the 60s. That does not bode well for new home prices either, and home builder stocks sagged to their lowest point since last fall. Lennar down 3%, Pulte Homes 2.5% off, Beazer Homes down 2.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. The nation's largest retailers announced sales figures for the month of March. IRS Commissioner Mark Everson joins the Senate Finance Committee for a discussion on filing taxes as the deadline looms. And late-night talk show host David Letterman celebrates his birthday, the Big 6-0. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Figuring out patent law can be about as much fun as deciphering the tax code. Okay, probably less fun than that. And now it looks like tax accountants might have to do both at the same time. A growing number of inventors are patenting strategies that could save you money on your taxes. If you use one of those strategies without permission, well, that's called patent infringement. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
So this story about patents on tax strategies starts out in a field. Down the street from my house, where a few cows live next to their owner's 50-style brick ranch. I've been waiting for quite some time to hear that cow moo. See, that cow could be worth a lot of money in tax relief to its owner, just like an alpaca or a llama would. And in fact, alpacas and cows are sometimes deductible. The method isn't patented, but there's a chance it could be. And if it were, then we'd all have to pay a royalty fee to use the strategy, or maybe not use it at all.
Well, I've got a few donkeys myself, so maybe I should rush out and file the patent myself on that idea.
That's Josh Lerner of Harvard Business School. He says such a patent wouldn't be all that far-fetched. As proof, he points to the patent involving retirement accounts, IRAs. It covers a method that helps you decide whether you'll save money on your taxes if you convert your standard IRA to a Roth IRA.
It's not really rocket science, right, in the sense that you're going to think about what your tax rate is now, what your best guess in terms of the tax rate is going to be going forward, and what kind of rate of return you expect to get during the years until you retire.
Lerner says such a basic calculation doesn't deserve government protection, but it got it. A court ruling in the 1990s gave birth to tax patents. The decision made it clear that business methods are patentable. Tax strategies are considered a subset of business methods. Since 1992, the U.S. Patent Office has issued 53 tax strategy patents, and 84 are pending. This trend has the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants calling for reform. The group's Tom Oxenschlager says not only do taxpayers and preparers now have to know Internal Revenue Service regulations,
but they also have to be a little bit concerned as to whether they're violating a patent when they're doing some fairly normal tax planning ideas when they're preparing their tax returns.
Someone's already been sued for using a patented tax strategy. It was an Aetna insurance executive in Connecticut. He apparently used a tax method that shields certain stock options from taxation. Robert Slane owns the patent. He had to work to come up with it.
Just a lot of reading and thinking outside the box.
So if you were him, wouldn't you want to be compensated for all that midnight oil burning? His attorney, Steve Milbrath, likely thinks that you would. And he says patents could make tax shelters or deductions more transparent. That would create a level playing field.
There is no smoke-filled room. There is no secret filing of tax returns with the details buried.
Intellectual property lawyer Stephen Schreiner says to be patent-worthy, inventions have to be new, useful, and non-obvious. If a tax strategy fits that description, he says there's no reason why it shouldn't get one. Schreiner says the people calling for an end to tax patents are special interest groups with an axe to grind.
The parties that are really pushing this issue before the Congress are tax attorneys and accountants.
And Congress has responded to the issue. Senator Barack Obama included a tax patent exclusion in a bill he recently co-sponsored. But for this tax season, you might want to make sure your tax strategy isn't owned by someone demanding a licensing fee. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao got on a plane for Tokyo, Japan this morning. It's a rare meeting between the leaders of the two countries. There are tensions between them going back 70 years or more. But Wen and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe are planning to announce at least one area of agreement on global warming, specifically what to do about it when the Kyoto protocols expire in 2012. China doesn't hold to the Kyoto emissions limits. Neither does the U.S., of course. And in both countries, environmentalists are raising all manner of red flags. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from South Central China on the looming problem of water supply.
Mr. Kong fishes for a living at Dongting Lake. It's China's second biggest and an agricultural hub on the Yangtze River. Kong is 45. He cusses. He rants about how fishing is awful these days because of water pollution and how the Beijing Communist Party does nothing about it.
They talk about protecting Dongting Lake, but they don't mean it. They don't care about the common people, just the rich and powerful.
Rich, as in the Bing paper industry, he says, the mills that dump waste into the lake. This fisherman says that kills the ecosystem and his livelihood.
My family has fished for seven generations, hundreds of years of history. But the fish are gone. My son has left, gone to the coast for migrant work.
He ferries us over to a narrow canal filled with paper factory leftovers. The water's dark brown and reeks. Local officials say 101 paper mills operate on this lake, and just two of them meet environmental standards for wastewater.
Basically, they turn all these rivers and lakes as their natural sewers.
Environmental activist Ma Jing is the author of the book China's Water Crisis.
You see a very rapid deterioration of certain rivers and lakes, specifically due to the paper industry.
Half of China's rivers are deemed too polluted to drink from, and more than 100 Chinese cities face what authorities call severe water shortages. The main problem is there's just not enough of it to start out with. So the farmers, the fishermen, the power plants, and the battery factories can't always operate full bore. David Dollar heads the China office at the World Bank.
there will definitely be some costs. You know, it will probably reduce the economic growth rate to some extent. So there are trade-offs, and people are having a very active debate about that.
The World Bank thinks the cost of pollution and resource shortages shave off 8 to 12% of China's GDP that drags on the global economy. But here's the rub for many Americans. Farmers like these are leaving the countryside by the millions, no longer able to coax crops out of parched soil. So they're taking jobs in factories that in some cases compete directly with American companies. David Dollar.
And that's the source of this pretty endless supply of workers coming to cities who work at what seem like very low wages in the manufacturing sector.
China's water crisis has been a long time in the making. In the 1950s, retired communist soldiers sang, "We workers are powerful," as they swarmed the riverbanks, siphoning water for farms and factories. Political philosopher Daniel Bell of Tsinghua University says it was part of a larger Marxist ideal.
The environment is there for humans to use for their own purpose, in particular to improve their productivity. And the idea that we need to worry about the long-term consequences regarding the environment and the ecology was not taken very seriously.
It is now. Local officials near Dongting Lake this month shut down scores of small, dirty paper mills. But will they stay closed? Benjamin Van Roy of Holland's Leiden University researches legal compliance in China.
A lot of them, they're closed down officially, the gates are sealed, and then operations start again. So what happened since 2002 or 2003 is the authorities have actually used dynamite to completely destroy these factories.
Destroy the factory to save the lake. Drastic measures for drastic environmental times, at least when it comes to China's most valuable liquid asset. In Hunan, southern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, mutual funds, IRAs, and college savings. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE or TRowePrice.com. And by the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, we always try to give you tomorrow's news today on the program, so how's this one? Mushy peas into applesauce, anybody? Nestle's has had a hankering for baby food for years. Back in the early 90s, it tried to buy the baby food behemoth Gerber, but it lost out in the bidding war. There's word today Nestle's finally succeeded and will announce a $5 billion deal to buy Gerber tomorrow. Nestle is the biggest maker of infant nutritional products in the world, but it never did manage to have a baby food brand right here in the U.S. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 89 points on worries about what the Fed might do on inflation. That's almost 0.75%. The Nasdaq down 18 points, 0.75% there as well. The S&P 500 dropped 9 points. That is 0.75%. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, and Joel Stein. Next time on the program, should English learners be subjected to No Child Left Behind?
Why put a test in front of them that they don't know, they can't read English, they don't have the basic literacy levels that are necessary. So you won't have a valid test, so why bother putting a test in front of them?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.